This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Olympic Games were founded on high ideals that politics could be set aside to clear the field for athletic competition. The Olympic Charter expressly opposes the mixture of politics and sport. Yet, of course, the Games have been used to make political points over and over again. By nations, the Nazi Olympics in 1936 Berlin and reciprocal Cold War boycotts in Moscow and Los Angeles in the 1980s. By groups including the terrorists who murdered Israeli athletes at Munich and by any number of individuals. The upcoming Summer Olympics in Beijing are no exception. Steven Spielberg quit as an artistic advisor to the opening and closing ceremonies because of his views on China's role in Sudan's Darfur province. A Dutch lawmaker suggested that a boycott of the opening ceremonies be staged to protest China's record on human rights, and the masks that some athletes may wear to protect their lungs could also be seen as a statement on the environment. Today we'll take a look back at the intersection of politics and sports in the Olympic Games and look ahead to the role of reform and protest at this summer's Games. We want to hear from athletes and from fans. Should politics play a role in the Olympic Games? Have you been moved by protests at past Games? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. One of the athletes who was moved to act during the last Winter Olympic Games is Joey Cheek. He won a gold medal for speed skating at Turin. Since then, he's founded Team Darfur and is now a student at Princeton University. He joins us from studio on campus there. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Neil, thanks for having me.
And at the post-event news conference in Turin, you announced you would donate your winnings to help refugees from Darfur, called on your sponsors to join that cause as well. And I wonder, was this venue at the Winter Olympic Games the right place to make a political statement, do you think?
Well, it's funny. At the time, no one in the media or anywhere else in the world had anything to say about me making a political statement. It was just, look at this great gesture a young man's making to donate money to help kids in a war-torn region in Africa. So we raised a lot of money, and people thought it was pretty much universally great, and what I was doing was within the ideal Olympic spirit. It wasn't until I learned a bit more about the crisis, and as I got more involved in it, began to realize, you know, maybe we should also do something to stop these guys, these men, women, and children from being slaughtered, that now all of a sudden I was making political statements. So my naivety faded quickly, I think, as I began to wade into what's really causing these problems.
Also, but one thing to make a statement about Darfur of whatever sort in Italy, and another to make that statement in Beijing.
Exactly. Although, as we've seen with some of the statements coming out of Great Britain, Belgium, and New Zealand, maybe the countries we thought freedom of speech were pretty entrenched may not be as tightly entrenched as we thought.
And those are countries, among others, that at one point Britain was going to ask for signed commitments, contracts that forbade any of its athletes from making political statements.
Right, under penalty of being removed from the team, in fact. And they handed these out over the weekend two or three weeks ago, sort of in secret. And as soon as the public got word of it, there was quite an outcry.
Yet are there limits? You did it at your news conference after you won a gold medal. Again, you won the gold medal, you get a news conference. I guess you can say whatever you want to say. But would it have been appropriate for you to raise a Save Darfur banner at the on the medal stand, for example?
Well, I think they would have been hard-pressed to stop me had I decided to do that. However, I'm certain that there would have been repercussions. The IOC has codified in their charter that any sort of show of political symbols, such as raising a banner or wearing a T-shirt that may say something, is forbidden. You're only allowed to wear your nation's colors while competing. And I have to say, to a certain extent, I certainly understand and can appreciate where they're coming from. But the fact is, the Olympics was founded on an ideal that it's not just a sporting festival. It's a sporting festival that hopefully can transcend athletic competition. That we can, through this competition and through these games, we can improve the state of human rights. And at some point, that's very lofty language. And if you're not willing to live up to it in your day-to-day reality, then you're really just you're kind of just floating pretty words and not living up to them.
And do you also see some irony, perhaps, in the idea that the nations, which together form the International Olympic Committee, sometimes found it in their interests to make a political statement or two at the Olympic Games?
Right. Well, you know, I don't think any nation bids for the Olympics just because they really want to host a great sporting event. I think every nation that hosts the Olympics looks at this as their opportunity to show off their economic, political, all of the great things that their nation can contribute to the world and all of the great things they hope to accomplish. So, I mean, there's a lot of politics involved just in getting an Olympic Games to your bid city. And it's pretty ironic when a country bids for games and says, these are the steps we have to take to get them, and this is our political viewpoint and why we want to show it's great. But there's no politics in the games.
Mm-hmm. Of course not. Five-time Olympic gold medalist Michael Johnson said he's detecting some pressure on athletes to make political statements. A tremendous amount of pressure to place on young athletes suggested the news media not question competitors about such matters. It should not be assumed that because an athlete competes in Beijing and does not speak out against China's record, that they agree with it or that they don't care. Would it be wrong to put pressure on athletes to wear a Save Darfur or Free Tibet t-shirt?
I absolutely think it would be wrong to try and force athletes to stand up for something that if they don't feel strongly enough about to speak out on their own. My mission in Team Darfur was merely to find athletes that are interested in trying to help the citizens of Darfur, and that could range from simply just raising awareness all the way up to making political statements and any sort of range in between. I spent 15, 20 years of my life competing and training for the Olympics. And I understand that when you get there, your focus is to compete and to represent your country and to do the best you can. I think it would be unfair of me to ask anything of someone else that I wouldn't want asked of myself. And I came to this of my own volition. I actually came to this realization or worldview because of my experience as an Olympian.
So what would you expect members of a Team Darfur to do in Beijing?
Well, I would never ask anyone to jeopardize anything or any chance of being removed from a team or cause any harm to themselves or their family. What we do is we offer a menu of options. We say, if you want to sign up for this, we'll show you all the stuff we know, and we'll show you other people talking about Darfur and contrarian views as well, so you can make your own mind up. And then if you want to speak at a rally or attend a political event or speak to the media, we'll help connect you with those people. And if you want to do more, we'll help you be in touch with the right people as well. We sort of act as a funnel for athletes who are concerned about Darfur in particular.
And could that potentially include some sort of protest or some sort of statement at an Olympic venue at the Olympic Games?
It's certainly possible an athlete could make that stand. I feel like in some ways I sort of tried to make that stand, although at the time it was not perceived as a political stand, at the Torino Olympics. If someone feels strongly enough about it, and I believe it's a cause worthy of feeling that strong, then of course I would help support them in whatever way possible. However, it's not my intention to try and, pressure anyone or this isn't like we want to try and ruin the Olympics or make it this very contrarian viewpoint. We just think that the Olympic spirit really entails using your position to help others.
And joining us now is Anita DeFrance, president of LA84 Foundation, an organization that supports youth sports programs, and she's a member of the International Olympic Committee. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, and hi.
Hi. And would you agree with what Joey Cheek just said, that part of the spirit of the Olympic Games is to help make life better for people in other places?
Well, the Olympic Games belong to the world, and we select hosts for those games. It happens that Beijing will be the host of the games coming up. What happens during the games is that people come together, living in the Olympic Village, which is the most amazing place on the face of the earth, where there are 10,000 people, all successful, who've been selected by their countries to represent them at these games. And they come away changed, just as Joey. He was changed after the games, and he talked about providing his resources to help that one group of folks. There's immense suffering throughout the world. Darfur is one of the many places right now where there's immense suffering. And I know that Olympians are people who care. And I hope that Olympians are able to follow their own paths before and after the games. But the games belong to the world. And it is our duty as athletes to protect the opportunity for athletes to come after to have that experience, which is so powerful.
Can you understand, though, critics say, who take that a little further and say, it seems to us what you're doing is protecting the host country against criticism.
The host, as I say, it's just the host. The games belong to the world, and they have to be hosted someplace. Some community has to take a responsibility, and it's a great honor. It's true. It's a great honor to host those games, and we expect that the games will be treated well there. And most of all, we expect the athletes will be treated well and have their opportunity, just as Joey had, to have the test with history. It's very important.
Let's get a caller on the line, 800-989-8255, if you'd like to join us. Email is talk@npr.org. And Teresa's calling us from Palo Alto in California.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Anyway, I was speaking with your screener and was telling her the story of in the late 70s, I ran track in college, and I was running the quarter mile, which was transmogrifying into the 400 meters. And I was pretty good, and I was asked to train for the 80 Olympic team, and life got in the way, and I decided not to do it. I didn't have the family support that it took at the time to basically give up everything and train for a couple of years and travel all over the world. But I remember how I felt when I heard that President Carter had denied my friends, a lot of my friends, the chance to go to the Olympics, and I was really angry. I mean, my first reaction was just pure, unmitigated anger.
Anita DeFrance, you were one of those people who was denied the opportunity to participate in the Olympics in 1980.
Yes, and it was stunning that this nation, which I believe valued very much the right of the individual to make decisions, remember that the government had nothing to do with training the athletes or sending the athletes. It was all individual choice. As the caller just said, she didn't have the support. And this was before sponsorships and before the USOC could really do a whole lot.
There was no money. I mean, that's why I had to get a real job, and I just didn't have time to train at that point.
Understood.
Or money. I definitely didn't have money, so that was that was a problem.
So the fact that we were told that we couldn't go, and there, you know, was just, to me, an outrage. It didn't make any sense.
Teresa, thanks very much for the call.
All right, thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye. We're going to continue to talk with Anita DeFrance and with Joey Cheek. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We're also going to be talking about one of the most famous incidents in Olympic Games history, when Tommy Smith and John Carlos saluted in anger at the 1968 Games in Mexico City. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We often talk about the sport of politics on this program. This hour, we're talking about the politics of sports, in particular the Olympic Games, which have had a long history of reflecting international political events on the athletic field, sometimes even at the medal podium. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from Tommy Smith, who raised his fist in a Black Power salute on the medal stand in 1968. But right now, we're talking with Anita DeFrance, a member of the International Olympic Committee, and also still with us, Joey Cheek, an American speed skater who donated his winnings from the Winter Olympics a couple of years ago to children in Darfur and is now the founder of Team Darfur. Of course, we want to hear from you as well. Is the Olympic stage the right place for political statement or protest? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And I wonder, Joey Cheek, as you've been listening to what Anita DeFrance has been saying, is anything that you're thinking about doing or what your Team Darfur is about, is that inconsistent with what she's talking about?
I actually think we have a vast common ground between what she's speaking about, what I'm speaking about. You know, when she mentioned the Olympic Village, I had to smile, and I still get shivers thinking about it. It really is, when you walk into that dining hall and you sit down with athletes from all over Europe and Asia and Africa, and we all are wearing our nation's colors on our back, and yet we all sit at the same table and you know, break bread together. This is one of those moments that she said changes your life, and it's absolutely true. It does. What I took from that was that I had this unique experience to realize that athletes from China or from Europe or from Asia, from Africa, we really have such a common bond in our love of sport, but that we have these same innate rights, I think. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to argue that anyone is less deserving of any of these same rights. And that's what sort of led me over the years to this sort of social consciousness. What we want to do and what I hope to do with Team Darfur and what I hope athletes around the world will do in their own way is that we can use this platform to share that experience. And to point out, if we've got that spotlight, we've got a few moments, you're going to be asked the same, you know, banal questions over and over again about how it feels to win medals, which is, of course, outstanding. But you've got a real chance to try and make a genuine improvement. And to me, that is what the Olympics can be about. This is the ideal that we aspire to. And I think if we use that opportunity for helping others, then we can do something great with it.
Let's see if we can get Cindy on the line, and Cindy's with us from Traverse City in Michigan. Cindy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
I love the Olympics. I watch them. I watch both the Winter and the Summer Olympics and enjoy them, but I feel because of China's involvement in Darfur and Tibet and their unclean air and all of the crap they keep sending around the world, they should be boycotted altogether.
Please don't use that term.
And not just ask specific athletes or ask the athletes, but just as a whole.
Anita DeFranca, I think we heard you say, please don't use that term. I assume you meant boycott.
Well, yeah, because boycott, every time there's been a boycott of the Olympic Games, the athletes are the ones that are hurt. Nothing changes in the world, except those athletes are denied the opportunity to experience the Games, to share, and perhaps be great ambassadors in the future. You know, boycotts are purposeless, and certainly even 1980, nothing changed. Not a thing, except the lives of the athletes were somehow diminished. So we need to get away from that. Yeah, there are a lot of athletes who have social consciousness and are doing things before they become Olympians. Not every Olympian wins a gold medal and has a podium to say anything. And again, there's immense suffering throughout the world. So I understand why some people think it's important to focus on Darfur. And I do hope there's something that can be done there. But I do also believe that we need to make certain that the games endure and flourish. And to do that is very, very important. We have to have more people experience being at the games, and we need to have more people, the spectators, who see what happens, who see the extraordinary performances. It's interesting. We have so much on television now. You really don't, unless you're there, you have no idea, for example, how long the long jump really is. You don't know. You see it on television. You just don't have an idea how high the high jumpers are jumping, or you know what it takes, how the distance of 2,000 meters across the water in a race, which we did in my sport in rowing. But it's just an extraordinary thing that happens. And so, as you can tell, my goal is, I understand people have a lot to say about things before the games, and it happens every time. It happens every time. Before the L.A. Games, it was smog, too, folks. And you could see the mountains during the time of the games. That's why we keep having the games, so that there can be more experiences. And I hope the athletes, especially the athletes on the U.S. team, understand that they'll be able to compete. And the things that they do outside of the games are certainly important as well. But during the games, you get to commit your competition there, which cannot come again for 4 years, if ever.
Cindy, Neil, Cindy, thanks for the call. You were about to say, Joey Chi?
Yeah, if I may, just briefly. You know, during the games, there are going to be miles of column inches written, and there's going to be a vast amount of stories told. Mm-hmm. And what I've found is that, in some way, you know, there's always going to be some sort of scandal that media is going to be looking for and trying to find, and there's always something they can harp on, and this is bad, or this is bad, or whatever. I believe that, you know, when Anita speaks about enriching the Olympics, if athletes are able to be as brilliant off the field in their efforts as they are on the field, I think that's a story that can make a big difference. And when we say, you know, well, I really hope something improves in Darfur, I really hope something improves in terms of environmental concerns. Well, if you're able to be an athlete and have the eyes of the world on you and compete brilliantly and be able to use that platform for something, then you go a step beyond. You're no longer hoping. Well, you're now taking an active role.
I think sometimes we don't fully understand. It wasn't the eyes of the world. It was primarily in the United States. Each athlete has probably a platform in their own country. There might be international media there at the press conference, but you know, everyone wants to hear about their own athletes and what they have to say.
Anita DeFrance, I was just going to say thank you very much because we have to move on, but okay. We appreciate your fighting through the flu to be with us today.
Okay, and my regards to Tommy, and they have a great story to tell.
Anita DeFrance, president of LA 84, an organization that supports youth sports programs and a member of the International Olympic Committee. And she just mentioned Tommy, that's Tommy Smith, One of the most memorable collisions of politics and sports came at the 1968 Summer Games in Mexico City, where Smith and John Carlos stood on the medal stand and raised black-gloved fists in the air in the classic Black Power salute. Gold medalist Tommy Smith joins us now from his home in Atlanta, Georgia. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And you made, a decision that I think anybody who saw it never forgot for a moment in 1968. Why did you choose to make that protest at that moment?
Well, it took time. It was a year and some months in preparation for some type of social action. But it wasn't the Olympic Project for Human Rights on the victory stand. It was Tommy Smith who helped in organizing the OPHR.
And the OPHR?
Yeah, the Olympic Project for Human Rights.
And that had a number of goals, specific protests?
Yeah, there were certain things immediately and idealistically we wanted to tackle, such as South Africa, such as the negative coaching numbers of black coaches in colleges, and the NYAC and its treatment of athletes, and there were others dealing with the
Muhammad Ali's title had been stripped and that sort of thing.
That's right. You know, so there was time for the athletes to say something. Those athletes who thought there was a need to become socially viable, of course.
And yet some people say you're there on the medal stand representing your country. Yes, you can make those statements, but there are other places and other times to do it.
Where? Had they been made within the United States, they'd have been flushed down the toilet just like they flushed Muhammad Ali down. Sometimes there's help needed doing the same thing on in other forces and other fields. So that was a platform. Sure, it was an American athletes, and I'm part of America. And that was a platform for me to take the chance on trying to make the understanding that we need to continually work on an equal basis and perform as equals and not as a second-class citizen or a caste system that within a country that has a democracy.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Deirdre with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I let out a little chuckle when Mr. Smith said, in response, you know, to there are other times and other places, when he says where, because that is the same way that I feel for me. And I was just a twinkle in my mother's eye in 68. That is just so profound. It resonates with me, the strength that that statement made. And then when you think about the Munich incident, and the statement and the strength of that statement, completely other side of the spectrum, Mr. Smith and Mr. Carlos, God bless them, and all the forces behind them that helped them to make that stand. No one got hurt behind that, but it was so powerful, and that was the beauty of it. So I thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you very much.
You're mighty welcome.
That's it. I'm gone.
All right, Deirdre. Thanks very much for the call. Is that kind of, as she said, it had tremendous power, but is that moment appropriate for all kinds of political protest? Is it appropriate? Well, not just for free...
I can't speak for the athletes who were there. 68 of the athletes coming in a few months, but this was the 60s. It was a time of social change. Many things were happening. Many wars were being waged, and one that was almost illegal. There were riots. There were assassinations. There was a lot of things that needed attending to, and it was a world issue, not just an issue in our country. And the social attitudes of the athletes were worldwide, and not just during the 1968 Olympic Games. What most folks don't realize is that the Olympic Games are just a big political forum, like anything else that a country uses to make itself look good and look strong. And I think this country is only strong as the people it produces.
Let's get another caller in. This is Lane. Lane with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hi. Good afternoon, or good morning, Mr. Smith, or good afternoon, as it were. How are you, sir?
I'm sir. Fine. Thank you, sir.
Quite frankly, I take issue with your posture in 1968, and basically I believe that you disrespected the country in a really bad way, sir, and I don't understand why you chose to make your stand, why you chose to make your decision at that point in time. And I'll take my comments off the air, sir.
All right, Lane. Thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
I'm sure that's not the first time you've heard that question.
No, we have a lot of tunnel visionaires, you know, that they believe if you do something right in your country, that everybody's going to know about it. I don't think so. In fact, all due respect to that person who just called, he is not alone in his negative sentiments about the victory stand in Mexico City. But if he really wants to know from A to B, you just spend a couple of dollars and pick up the autobiography of Tommy Smith, Call Silent Gesture, and it will clear your mind much more than my talking to you here on this particular instance.
And just to point out, it was not something that you took risk-free. In fact, you were stripped of your Olympic medal and sent home. So this had a cost.
We were, forcefully removed from the Olympic Village. We were sent home, all our identification removed so that we had to come home, and we were banned from further competition. Further international competition. I just had started my career. In terms of our medals taken away, a lot of people believe that, but that would have been a much bigger battle than the victory stand had they approached me to take my medal away.
Hmm. Tommy Smith, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Nice talking to you.
Tommy Smith won the 200-meter race in the 1968 Olympics. His raised fist gesture on the medal podium is among the most iconic images from the Olympic Games. You can see a photograph of that moment at our website at npr.org/talk. Again, his book is called Silent Gesture, the Autobiography of Tommy Smith. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's not just news conferences and medal ceremonies that give athletes a platform. Many Olympians have their own blogs, and they will be allowed to blog from Beijing with the blessing of the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, within limits. No independent bloggers, athletes, or otherwise will be allowed to report on the actual games. According to the IOC, independent blogging is not journalism. Robert Cox disagrees. He's president and founder of the Media Bloggers Association. With us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Nice to be here.
Is it a good thing the IOC has decided to allow athletes to blog from Beijing?
Well, they may be getting more than they are bargaining for and what they're allowing to have happen here. But if you take a close look at what they're putting out is what athletes can and can't do, they are narrowly limiting exactly what constitutes a blog and what the athletes are allowed to do.
On the commercial side, their instructions are pretty clear. You can't infringe on the broadcast rights of the media that have paid to cover the games, the television and radio networks.
Right. So that means no video, no audio, therefore no podcasts. And there's severe limits on still photography as well.
And do you think they're going to be able to enforce these?
Well, they weren't able to do that in Athens. They weren't able to do that in Turin. And I'm not really sure how they think they're going to be able to do it in Beijing.
And would there be an athlete get into trouble if on his own time, blogging from his place in the Olympic Village or wherever, he said, free Tibet or save Darfur?
Well, the same penalty that Tommy Smith just described applied to the athletes in Athens and Turin, removing their credentials, theoretically legal or monetary damages against the athletes. But none of that was enforced in the breach. And so to a large extent, this is a matter of if you can't beat them, join them. The IOC was not able to prevent blogging in those other Olympics. And so now what they're doing is trying to put it under an umbrella of IOC sanction.
And yet, again, everybody will immediately jump to the irony. China, one of the countries most restrictive for its own citizens' use of the Internet, well, I guess it's going to be the first place where Olympic athletes get to blog.
Well, get to blog with IOC sanction, yeah. And then just keep in mind something else, which is they may be blogging from Beijing. It doesn't necessarily mean anyone's going to be reading them in China.
Of course, they're going to be reading them in other countries around the world where there's interest in that. But what about this, the restriction of the rights on athletes, including their own performances?
Well, I thought it was interesting if you read through the restrictions. They can't take pictures of any other athletes. They can't interview any other athletes. So that sort of means you're left to sitting in your room, looking out your window, blogging about what you see, as long as it doesn't include anybody doing anything that's an athlete or any other kind of accredited member of an IOC or an NOC organization.
I guess you can write about the food as long as you like it.
I think there's going to be a lot of movie reviews, food reviews, and travel reviews.
Robert Cox, thanks very much for your time today. Robert Cox, president and founder of the Media Bloggers Association, with us from our bureau in New York. We're going to continue taking calls with Joey Cheek, the American speed skater who won a gold medal at the last Winter Olympic Games and since then has founded Team Darfur. Also, when we come back, in 1936, Adolf Hitler opened the games in Berlin and athlete Margaret Lambert hoped to compete on Germany's high jump team. She was removed because she was Jewish. We'll look back at the Berlin Games with her in a few minutes, so stay with us. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're talking about politics and the Olympic Games. Our guest is Joey Cheek, an American speed skater who won the gold medal in 2006 and in the 500-meter speed skating race. Afterwards, he told a news conference that he was going to donate his winnings to children in Darfur. He's now president of Team Darfur. And I know you've been sitting there patiently, Joey Cheek. You've not had an opportunity to respond to some of the things that Tommy Smith had to say, or for that matter, Robert Cox, about the restrictions on bloggers in Beijing.
Right. Well, I'd like to mention, and I wasn't alive when Tommy Smith made his iconic gesture in the 68 games. And so I don't know a lot of the political undertones that must have been going on at the time. However, if you look at that situation in the 60s, Tommy was expected to go to the Olympics. Mr. Smith was expected to go to the Olympics, represent our country, make America look great, and then come back home and once again be relegated to second-class citizenship. And it just it blows my mind that the audacity that someone would say, yeah, we expect you to do this for us to help us look good, but we're not going to give you the same treatment. And now, although it may not be known, but if you go to the United States Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, there is a massive picture of him on the medal stands. And there's stands in all of Olympic literature from that picture because it's such a powerful picture. And what was perceived at the time as a grave affront and an affront to the Olympic Committee and to the U.S. is now looked at as a hero. So I think oftentimes doing the right thing may not be that popular at the time.
So again, would that gesture now be appropriate if you were a Serb and won a medal for the new nation of Kosovo? If you were a Hutu and won one for Rwanda?
I would think absolutely. The Olympics, to me, is more than just a sporting competition. And the reason I feel that way is because I had the experience to meet these people and to spend time in the village. I was brought up and really, in many ways, if it weren't for the help of the United States Olympic Committee and my situation, I would never have been able to make it. And in these cases, athletes that have been subjugated to whatever oppression, if they're able to overcome all that and make it to the Olympics, I think the world deserves to hear that story. And if they wait till after the Olympics are over, no one's listening.
Let's get Ken on the line. Ken with us from Fort Myers in Florida. Ken, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
In listening to the comments this afternoon, I am struck by the contradictions that I'm hearing. On the one hand, the young lady who felt that she was cheated out of an Olympic opportunity or that her friend was made the assertion that these are individual athletes. They're the countries, as political entities, have no right to say they do or do not participate. And then on the other hand, we hear that when the salute was made in Mexico City, that was disrespectful to the country. Now, which is it? Are the individuals going as individuals? Are they going as representatives of the country? I don't think we can have it both ways.
Joey Cheek, did you go as Joey Cheek or Joey Cheek USA? I was asking an Olympian what he thought. Go ahead, Joey.
I think it's probably pretty difficult to distinguish the two because I happen to be Joey Cheek and I happen to be an American as well. I think I represented my country to the absolute best of my ability. And I think and of course I could never speak for Mr. Smith, but when I look at the actions of Mr. Smith in the 68 Olympics, I think what he did made America better for it.
Let's get Ruth on the line. Ruth with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I want to say that I felt very proud and honored as I listened to our gold medalist talking about the fact that he had given his own, his earnings to the children of another country, regardless of where they were from. They were for children, and it was not a political statement. But I certainly felt that he was a true Olympian, that he really represented the finest in our country. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, gold medalist.
More thank you so much.
Good things for you, and may you continue helping. Bye.
Ruth, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And, Joey Cheek, I guess we're going to say thank you very much, too, for your time today. Hard to find a better moment for you to go out on.
I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Joey Cheek joined us today from a studio at Princeton University, where he's now a student. He's also the head of Team Darfur and looks forward to the Beijing Games later this year. Politics and propaganda were prominent at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, Germany. Ceremonies were officially opened by Adolf Hitler. The Olympic rings appeared next to Nazi swastikas, and many Jewish athletes were not allowed to compete. Among them, Margaret Lambert. She joins us now by phone from her home in New York. If you remember the 1936 Games, or if you'd like to ask Margaret Lambert about her experiences, our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, where you'll also find a picture of the 1936 opening ceremonies in Berlin. And Margaret Lambert, it is very good to speak with you today on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hi. And I understand I misspoke earlier. I said that you had hoped to participate in the Games in 1936. In fact, you were forced to participate as an athlete.
That's true.
Go ahead. Tell us what happened.
Well, I was in England at the time because my future in Germany was nil. So my father came and said, I have to come home because I'm supposed to be on the German Olympic team. And I couldn't believe it because we were absolutely ostracized in Germany. Jewish people were dirt. And all of a sudden, I'm supposed to be on the Olympic team. That I couldn't understand it. But it happened. I went back. And that's how this whole thing developed.
In fact, as I understand it, there were threats of a boycott that year by, among others, the United States.
I mean, that was the whole reason why I was forced into this deal.
So
because the Americans didn't want to come.
The Americans didn't want to come.
Many other countries.
If Jewish athletes could not participate on the German team.
Right.
And
it wasn't only the German team, but, I mean, there were very few Jewish athletes who were eligible.
And obviously,
to compete, but it was just, are they allowed or are they not allowed? And that was the thing. And, of course, the Germans tried to put the best foot forward and got away with it.
And by sending your father to bring you back to Germany to compete, was the message basically your family's in danger if you don't come back?
Yes. And that could not be done by letters or telephone calls because everything that had to do with Jewish people was, what do you call this? I mean, you know, everything was...
censored?
The letters were opened, and sometimes I lose my, you know, my brain doesn't work all the time.
Yeah, me too. I have that problem as well, but
yeah,
you're doing pretty well.
I'm a lot older than you.
Yeah, I have less excuse.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. But let me ask...
Censored,
yes.
I got the word.
But you did go back, and I understand, in training, put up some results that would have certainly qualified you for the team.
Oh, yes.
And then got a letter.
Well, the letter was sent one day after the Americans got onto the boat to sail towards Berlin. And I suppose the Germans figured as long as they're on the way already, they wouldn't go back and, you know, say we're not coming. So that's the way, this is, I assume this, I don't know this as a fact, but the Americans went on the ship on the 15th of July, and I got, the letter was written on the 16th of July.
And the letter said, basically, you're not going to the Olympic Games.
Well, this was a letter that was sent to all the, just like a form letter, that was sent to all the people who were not chosen. You know, there were many more. There were only three people for each
event, yeah.
Contest. And all the ones that were training and were not chosen got the same form letter, I suppose. But
yet,
they told me I wasn't good enough. And when I tell you that I jumped a meter 60, the 2 weeks before, and the Olympics were won with a meter 60. I think that tells the story.
And after that, you're then in Germany with your family. Could you watch the Olympic Games? Did you listen to them on radio?
Well, I keep saying I must have had amnesia because I have absolutely no recollection at all about the Olympics of 1936. Whether I boycotted it, I mean, there was no television, of course, and the radio was very, wasn't very good, and the newspapers, I lived in a small town. I don't even know if they had anything of the Olympics in there. But I cannot in any way, shape, or form remember anything of the Olympics, of the 1936 Olympics.
Of course, many Americans remember Jesse Owens, the great runner, winning so many medals at the Olympic Games in 1936, and at least figuratively poking his finger in Hitler's eye.
Oh, that was beautiful. That was absolutely wonderful.
So
it wasn't so great how they treated him when he came back to the United States.
Indeed, and that was one of the points that he made, the rest of his life, in fact.
Oh, yes. And may I just say, when I saw those two guys with their fists up on the victory stand, that made my heart jump. I thought that was beautiful.
That was John Carlos and Tommy Smith back in 1968.
Yes. Oh, yes. I thought that was great.
And did you expect in any sense that there would be some sort of demonstration at those games in Berlin in 1936, given what was going on in Germany at the time?
No. Nobody dared. I mean, you did one thing and said one wrong word and you were in a concentration camp. I mean, who would, people who liked and who were the Jewish people before, we had friends, Catholic, Protestant, it didn't matter before Hitler. And after that, we were mostly shunned by all our friends, and nobody would dare do anything.
We're speaking with Margaret Lambert, a former high jumper, was forced to try out for the German Olympic team in 1936 and then precluded from participation because she was Jewish. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Thomas. Thomas with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. I have a similar circumstance in my family. My grandfather was an alternate in the in track and field for the German team. And his daughter, who was, I think, 6 years old, it was my mother, was Jewish. And so he was not able to marry my grandmother until after the war. And my mom ended up in a concentration camp as well.
And your question for Margaret Lambert?
Well, I wanted to ask, does she remember somebody by the name of Kurt Zander or any of the team members?
No, I don't. Sorry.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Thomas. Yet that situation where people... How did you get out of Germany?
Well, they were very happy when you left. You know, it took quite some doing because the Americans were not very helpful in opening up their borders to refugees, and you had to go through the paces, go to the American consulate and wait, and they assigned numbers for everybody, and my husband's parents and 30 of his relatives died in a concentration camp because the Americans did not help. So I think my story must have gotten to the consulate. As a matter of fact, I have proof of that. And maybe they gave me a little bit preferable, treatment. And I got my affidavit or whatever they call this. And in May of 1937, I was able to come to the United States. And they allowed each Jewish emigrant to take along $4.
$4?
$4.
Did you spend it all in one place?
$4 bought you a couple of meals at the time. I ate a lot of spaghetti and meatballs because that was cheap.
Let's get another caller in. This is Arthur. Arthur with us from Michigan.
Yes, good afternoon, and thanks. I've been listening for the whole hour, and the comment I would like to make, I've been listening to all of your guests and your speakers. what Jesse Owens, of course, as the previous speaker mentioned, was the premier track star, won 4 gold medals. And I think it was a covert rather than an overt political statement that this black man from USA was able to overcome the supermen, the super race of Hitler's Germany, and win 4 gold medals in track. And I don't like the idea of overt political expressions. It doesn't belong at the Olympic Games. And that's my comment.
Hmm. Thank you, Arthur. I wonder, there was continuing mingling of politics and sports, of course, in Nazi Germany after the 1936 Games. Recently, the British media has drawn attention to a shameful episode where a visiting British soccer team in Germany was asked to make the Hitler salute on a visit in 1938. Politics and sports, what do you think?
Terrible. You know, the story of Marty Glickman?
Yes, of course.
Okay, well, I mean, you know, we shouldn't condemn all the Germans only.
Marty Glickman, of course, the famous sports broadcaster, you may remember, but a sprinter himself, a runner on the American team in 1936 in Germany, was denied a place on the relay team and would probably have come away with one of those gold medals.
He would have. And there was another Jewish stroller. There were four Americans, of course, and two were Jewish. And they would have won. They practiced a lot, you know, to pass the baton and so on. And then they were told they couldn't compete. And that was to please Mr. Hitler.
In retrospect, this is a long and sad story. What do you look forward to in the Beijing Games when they come up in, 6 months' time?
Well, I have very mixed feelings about it. I don't know if I'll still be alive. I'm 93 now, you know. And I'm not too happy about it, but the way the games were awarded to China, and I guess they have to follow it up. And if somebody stands up on a victory stand and makes an American and makes some kind of a statement, I would be very happy. But I don't know if they dare.
Margaret Lambert, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Margaret Lambert tied the women's high jump record in Germany in July 1936 before she was removed from the German Olympic team because she was Jewish. She joined us today from her home in New York. And tomorrow, Joe Palca will guest host for Ira Flatow on Science Friday. Ari Shapiro will be in this chair on Monday. We'll see you Tuesday. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News in Washington.